But I think the people right who were right within the armed forces at that time had a very great deal of difficulty in opposing what was a policy decision on the part of the headquarters. The difficulty that I think headquarters, in giving the devils their due, you know, the difficulty that they had was that they were running into an extremely tough position from the point of view of their finances. And obviously, if they had the view, and I know that this was true in some cases, if they had the view that they were not getting their money's worth, well, there's no question about it. I would have been in there doing exactly the same thing if, as an administrator of the armed forces finances, if I felt that I wasn't getting returns for the money that I had to account for. So they were, no matter how they felt personally about the situation, they couldn't really be supportive of the ideas.
How about, aside from the strictly financial material side, there still was the ideological side, which you...
Oh, sure, from. And this is what we advanced. Well, their ideas, of course, and here again, their argument was a logical argument, that, well, if that is the case, if we're really training citizens more than anything else, maybe the citizenship branch or somebody else ought to be paying for it and not coming out of the hard-pressed defense budget. Now, when you start shifting from one minister's pocket to another one, well, then you know that you're on a course that isn't going to be very highly successful. And it just didn't work out that way. I think it was a serious mistake, and I think that we may be unhappy about it in time. And this is why we made the arrangement with the university that these possessions that were our possessions should go into their custody for 10 years. If a unit isn't established or re-established in 10 years, well then it's really never going to be established. If it is established, well at least they can start off with something that is a usable commodity, as it were. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd have whatever it'd be, $100,000 worth of possessions that they'd be able to command at this point.
I wonder if the atmosphere on campus had anything to do with the disbandment of the COTC.
I didn't sense that. There was really not a sort of an unfortunate kind of attitude that had developed on the campus. We were left alone. We weren't really attacked by anybody, not as had occurred after the First World War.
I see. Was there any incidents comparable to what was going on American campuses?
No.
For example, student demonstrations to have the ROTC?
No, there were no demonstrations of this sort at all. UBC people are pretty sensible people, I think, and there was not a difficult university atmosphere at all with regard to any kind of issue, and I think that this was largely because the university administrations kept the doors open rather than close them to people who wanted to express their views. And there had not been any harassment on the part of our people who were on the campus in uniform and this sort of thing. Not as I understand occurred following the First World War.
Yes, it seems to be about three major cycles after the First World War, and then at the height of the Depression too, there was quite a strong anti-military movement. And during the later 60s, although as you point out, you didn't witness anything directly.
No, and I think that the Canadian peacekeeping role that had already been established had a strong influence on the people on the campus generally, not only the students but the professorial staff as well. How could one be arguing for the United Nations, for example, and be arguing against a military role for Canada if Canada was going to be one of the important peacekeeping elements?
Is this how you saw the purpose of the COTC, in your time, but also in the 50s, or you could even possibly go back to after the Second World War, I guess, with the establishment of the United Nations? Canada's armed forces being part of a sort of an international order.
This is one of the reasons why we brought in people from outside to talk to us about the world. That brought in geopolitical attitudes and political attitudes and international attitudes, and this was part of our program all the way along, that we felt that Canada has an important role, and it isn't just sort of like a secondary role, but one of the leading roles in the world in the police-keeping forces, because I don't think any of us believe that everybody is going to suddenly become angels, but they're going to have to have a policeman at the corner somewhere, even at the international corners. And where are these people going to come from, except from the university population? And where are they going to be useful, unless they are going to be useful in knowing more than just what an armed forces school will give them, but will in fact have a broad education, and they should be broadly educated, they should be broadly sympathetic toward international affairs and international people in order to carry out this role, an important role that Canada has.
Do you think that the advent of nuclear warfare affected the Corps? There must have been some soul-searching about what exactly do conventional arms accomplish with having the nuclear weaponry as really the major, ultimate sort of power.
I guess, sure, everybody reacted to the development of the supreme weapon, really. And early on, though, among our people and among our lecturers, and these were the people who understood the international scene, it became quite obvious to us that these were not, in fact, the ultimate weapons. These were the weapons that were probably not going to be used. They were going to be like biological warfare, because there's so much kickback that comes with these sort of weapons that the weaponry is going to be conventional weaponry, and the struggles that are going to take place are going to be struggles that are going to be local and not holocaustic kind of situations. And if they are going to be local, well, then you're going to have they could be any place in the world, and you're going to have understanding people to have that kind of involvement. And you're going to have to train them in the use of each one of the basic weapons of the foot soldier, really. The atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb established the power of the infantryman. That's really what it did.
On a very local level.
On a very local level. And this is why you...
Even though you have the major powers still behind the scenes,
that's right,
with their weapons.
That's right. That's right. They're all...
When it comes to that.
The real battle really takes place between the foot slogger, really. No matter if you have tanks or you have whatnot, it really ends up by being the fellow who is on the ground who makes a decision in many instances not to use a weapon at all.
Let's go to some of the peacekeeping activities of the Canadian Forces, and I wonder if the COTC was involved. You know, we go to the Suez Crisis. There were UN forces occupying areas in the Near East.
Yeah, there are some of our people that were there. There are some of our people that part of the Vietnam first peacekeeping observer units. We had regimental staff officers that had been in Vietnam. Brigadier Danby, who was here as area commander and who came out on a number of occasions to talk to us about Vietnam when people didn't even know how to spell the name, because he had been on the observer force over there. This kind of vicarious information was coming through to our people, and we had some people, some of our people who were trained as officers with us, who were in the Cyprus group, because they had become officers of the Queen's Own Rifles stationed in Victoria, and in fact one of our regimental staff officers was an officer of the Queen's Own Rifles and had spent a period of time on the peacekeeping force in Cyprus.
Was any of your training directed towards peacekeeping type of activities?
Oh, sure it was, yeah. And this was the whole area of geopolitics, because this is the Canadian role.
So, what kind of training would you have other than, say, international affairs discussion?
Oh, well, this is basically what it was, as understanding the role that that they would get in summer camp in terms of support to civilian government, you know, riot control and this sort of thing, which would be part of the which is part of the training of any officer, because he may become involved in support to civilian authority.
Would you say there's a definite change in the role from the Cold War period into the sort of peacekeeping period, which, say, maybe the mid-50s might divide the two eras?
Yes, there was certainly an attitudinal change, because during the Cold War period, the sort of basic military training was given a great deal of emphasis. The training of the use of arms was the was the important emphasis. And I think after that, when the peacetime role came in,
after Korea,
there was very definitely a changed role, because the armed forces actually changed their role too. Because you'll recall that during the Cold War period, the armed forces became responsible for a period of time for support of civil defense. And this was a role that the armed forces were not really, the regular armed forces were really not very happy with. That here they were being sort of like made into first aid workers or something like this, and they felt unhappy about this. And this was when Canada was looking at, how do we evacuate Vancouver to save as much of the population as you can, a next to impossible task, especially when there was only one bridge over the Fraser in those days. And there was, however, a change in attitude that came in sort of the late 50s, in which the role then became sort of subtly changed to a peacekeeping role, in which the emphasis was being placed on understanding of other people and other countries and places that people might go. And we had some of our own people in the COTC regularly go to Europe, for example, during the summer. They had their assignment in Europe. And they were attached to a regiment that had really what it amounts to, a peacekeeping role in the European theater.
That was, Europe was still more Cold War, isn't it? This is under the NATO organization.
Yeah, it was to that extent, but the Canadians viewed their position as being a peacekeeping role in the sense of occupying ground and waving the flag and this sort of thing.
COTC was in existence from 1928 to 68. That's 40 years?
40 years, yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, prior to that, it was in existence. It started off in 16 or something like that.
1914 to
19. Yeah, 14
or
19. Yeah.
That was UBC's contingent. Other universities had it continuously throughout the 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
In this time, well, in your time anyway, I guess since the Second World War, I suppose you had a lot of quite distinguished visitors.
Yes, we had a number of visitors over the years, and all of the lieutenant governors we had as guests on more than one occasion. I'd always felt that some of them took the view that when they came to our functions that they wouldn't have to go to all of the regimental functions of all of the regiments in the province, and this way that they could attend a tri-service affair and perhaps not attend the affairs of all of the other regiments, which would keep them awfully busy. They were. It was also attending at the university, which made it usually the lieutenant governor is the official visitor, so that they might be able to combine two events in that way. We would, when we had our graduation parade, we would have a luncheon for the distinguished visitors in the faculty club, including their ladies, and this was always a very nice affair. And then we'd have the parade and inspection with tea, for the graduates, or all of the members of the unit, plus the their parents. And then that evening we would have the annual ball of the, and that was a pretty full day that we put in on that particular day, both social and military and so on. Mm-hmm. But we had a visit in 1960 from Field Marshal Montgomery. Interestingly enough, his aide during that period of during his trip across Canada was Gordon Speedy, who was the fellow that was in the Mississauga Horse Guards with me years and years ago, and he was he had continued on in his military career right up until that time. And I know that Gordon Speedy said that he had never had quite the trip across Canada as he did with Field Marshal Montgomery, that he was a very great stickler for the right thing that needed to be done at the right time. And the only thing that I can recall for sure about that whole trip was that Gordon Speedy went into hospital with an ulcer not long after he had been out on the trip.
Did Field Marshal Montgomery give an address to the COTC?
He spoke to the COTC at a parade. He also attended in the mess on the 5th of May and spoke personally to a lot of the members of the unit at that time. And we tried to make an opportunity for as many of the members of the unit, which wasn't all that big at that time, to have an opportunity of talking with him, because he was a pretty distinguished fellow, you know, with an interesting kind of reputation as a soldier.
He had a high regard for the Canadian Army.
Yes, he did, and he had a high regard for young people, which was quite obvious that he seemed to be more relaxed. At least this was my observation of him, that he seemed to be more relaxed and less a field marshal, with the talking on a one-to-one basis with the officer cadets. And he was tighter up, really, with talking with the president of the university or with the people that he had to put on the Montgomery appearance, you see. And he was, I think a number of our fellows had quite a different view of him as a person after having spent 3 or 4 minutes talking with him. He was interested, he listened, and he seemed to remember what he was listening to, you know, that he would ask a question about something that they had maybe spoken about 5 minutes earlier, you think. That he wasn't just standing there and being talked to, but he was actually taking it in.
And do you remember some other visitors? You must have Lieutenant Governor George Perks.
Yes, oh yes, we had him as a visitor on a number of occasions, and he really, there is no question about it, that he enjoyed coming to our mess and coming to the parades. And he was just so obviously enjoying himself that I don't know of a single occasion, as a matter of fact, that he turned down an invitation that we had sent to him. not just to the annual parade or anything like that, but to our mess dinners and this sort of thing. If he possibly could make it, he would be there, and as I recall, he didn't turn us down on any occasion. But Mr. Wallace, I know, was there as a visitor, and he was largely responsible for shipbuilding industry in British Columbia here, and obviously the Navy people, they were his special pride, but he had a great view of the Navy people. Eric Hamber, when he was the Lieutenant Governor, and subsequently when he was Chancellor of the University, he was a visitor with us, and I knew Mr. Hamber very well because we had done a lot of work together about the medical school, and he again was a real believer in the young people of British Columbia, and displayed this in his talks to the regiment at the time that of our annual parades and this sort of business.
You had annual dinners with officers of the contingent, ex-officers, and officers in the regular army, in the local district, and from Ottawa.
Well, we used to put on an annual dinner, and this was a small dinner that we gave in the social suite of the faculty club. Prior to their annual inspection, not the parade, the annual parade at the end of the year, which was different from the this is the annual inspection of the units. And we would have a dinner for the inspecting officer, who could be an individual from Ottawa or the inspecting officer from the district or both. And we'd have the senior officers of the unit, and then we'd have the ex-commanding officers of the unit. Anybody that we, any ex-commanding officer that was available. And as you've seen one of the pictures, there are often, there are a fair number of them, as a matter of fact, and the 1963 group that they had together, I think, has all of the commanding officers, with one exception, ever since the COTC started in 1916 or 1914, I guess. And the one that is missing is President Westbrook, who was the first commanding officer. And that's pretty unusual, you know, over 50 years, and every one of the commanding officers were not only there, but present. And the most unusual one was Major General Letson, who had come from Ottawa specifically to attend that meeting of the ex-commanding officers of COTC, which is really a great thing.
What was the purpose of these dinners?
The purpose, I guess it was just to honor the visiting dignitaries.
Mostly social.
It was a social thing. It also sort of provided us with an opportunity, that is the senior officers, with an opportunity of talking sort of semi-business socially with the senior officer that we were responsible to. I don't think that the purpose of the dinner when it started was to sort of soften up the commanding, the inspecting officer, although I must say that we got some very good reports from them. Senior officer that we were responsible to. I don't think that the purpose of the dinner when it started was to sort of soften up the commanding, the inspecting officer, although I must say that we got some very good reports from them. And however, each of the units did extremely well in their own particular element. I know, and perhaps the Navy did the best of all, because out of the last 8 years, they had won the award for the best naval unit in Canada for 5 of those 8 years. Now that's pretty good. We often had citations for our parade, and so did for our unit, the same way as the Air Force did. We had a lot of awards that our individual officer cadets got from their training schools that they went to in the summertime. We expected them to bring the Sword of Honor back from Kingston or something like that. If they didn't, we would feel sort of put out about it. Colonel McLean was the one who was a real spearhead, not only as far as our own COTC was concerned, but in his relationships with many of the commanding officers across the country, because at that time, most of the commanding officers were ex-World War II officers, and a lot of them he knew personally, and he helped to spearhead the efforts made by the officers in trying to convince the headquarters people that they should not be so tough on the quotas. And I think for quite some number of years this did help out, although there was a pretty, at least I sensed, a pretty adamant attitude on the part of headquarters to reduce the number of officers that were being trained. And there was a great deal of complaint coming from headquarters that they were putting all this money into the training of people, and they were not really getting out as much of it as they ought to get by having individuals continue on in the militia or join up in the regular army. Now, as far as our unit was concerned, we had always had a high degree of success in the people going into the militia units or going into the armed forces. There are a great number of them that continued on, and we had this quite good relationship with the militia units, and many of them started to pick the militia unit they'd want to go into, and it's for this reason that we had a fair number of officers who were actually COTC people who were in the militia units.
And this is because of the close
working relationship. That's right. That's right. And I'm sure that a great deal had to do with the fact that we had wartime associations with some of the units. Doug Elsden, who is a COTC person, was a officer cadet with us before he joined up in the forces during the war. When he came back, very shortly afterwards, he was commanding officer of the 15th Field Regiment here, and there was an already established association. The same holds true with the Seaforth people. Bob Bonner was an ex-Seaforth officer, and Johnny McLean was an ex-Seaforth officer. Well, they had all kinds of friends who were in the Seaforth unit here. And this sort of personal contact that existed between the regiments worked out extremely well. We had a large contingent of medical people that were associated with the 24th Medical Company, which was located here in Vancouver, and some of them came through the COTC program. And of course, because they had relatively limited numbers of places that they went to in the summertime, namely Camp Borden was the main one that they went to, they got acquainted with the people from the medical side of the armed forces, and this was helpful to them in their careers. I think it worked out. It was a great arrangement.
Was this fight also continued when Lieutenant Colonel Morrison became
yes,
the commanding officer?
Yes, it was continued, and it continued down through to the time that I was CO, because I know that Morrison went to Ottawa on a couple of occasions having to do with this with at the CO's meetings, and we had a when the threat got really serious during the time that I was CO, we tried to enlist all the possible resources that we could, and that's when Gordon Shrum wrote to the Prime Minister, and we used everybody that we could possibly think of in order to try to influence the government because of our attitudes, that COTC was a good thing in its own right. And we weren't just battling for COTC. The other commanding officers were going through their channels as well.
I'd like to ask you about two things in relationship to this. First one is, you introduced sometime, I think in the 1950s, annual meetings with all the commanding officers of COTC contingents across Canada.
Yes. Yeah, those were introduced after the war, and were attended by the commanding officers. I'm not sure whether Bob Bonner went to them, but certainly I know that Johnny McLean and Morrison and myself were at CO's meetings. Now, originally, they were held in places like Kingston, for example, at the military college, and this was a meeting of all of the COTC commanders from across the country. Later on, and by the time I was commanding officer, they were regional meetings like Western Canada, and we got quite well acquainted with the commanders of the other units. And I think that this may have been sort of recognized by the headquarters people, that by bringing them all together, they developed quite a lot of political wallop under those circumstances. And consequently, the regional meetings were sponsored. And maybe it was a little cheaper or something like that to bring the regional groups, at least the smaller groups, together, traveling shorter distances and this sort of thing.
Yes. So you could discuss problems that were related to all the units?
Yeah. Problems, methods of recruitment, how to cope with maintaining a viable unit when your numbers get so small. Some of them, we were always pretty lucky. We filled our quotas, and by having what amounted to an integrated unit on the campus where the three armed forces elements were together, we had a viable setup right up to the end. But some of the others where there weren't, integration hadn't taken place, where they were by themselves, when you get down to a quota of, 8 or 10 people or something like this, and you have 2 years of 8 or 10 people, it's pretty hard to maintain a unit under those circumstances.
Yes. At these commanding officers' meetings, did you form resolutions and...
Oh, yes, yeah.
And with the resolutions...
And send them forward to headquarters. Sometimes they would be listened to. There is usually a representative of headquarters there who would, a fairly senior representative who would explain to us what the policies were for the next year or so, what the changing policies were. And it would give you an opportunity to put your own point of view forward.
Yes. In 1957 or 58, well, 58 for certain, the Conservative government became well established in Ottawa for their term. And I wonder if this was any different for you people as far as compared with the Liberals.
Well, I think there was a closer relationship, and this was largely through the Minister of Defense, who was a staunch Army general, and who was well disposed when he understood it. At first he didn't understand, but when he understood what the objectives were of COTC, he became a very strong supporter.
This is George
Perks. This is Major
Perks.
General Perks, yeah. And at first there was a real threat, and this was that they were going to be closed down, that they were going to be disbanded, that everything was going to be trained through the military colleges and this sort of thing. And I know that that our people at that time were very much in the forefront of trying to convince the Minister of Defense that this was the wrong direction to go. This was not being thought of in terms of any other major change in the armed forces. It wasn't a matter of integration or anything like this. It was, I think, purely an economic argument. And this was very strongly opposed, and I recall that there's quite a sudden change then in policy as soon as General Perks understood what it was all about. And he reversed the decisions that were being brought forward, presumably by his deputies or something. There was even for a period of time an increase in the quotas or something along this line that gave certainly a breath of revival to the armed forces on the campus.
You became commanding officer in 1964.
That's right, yeah.
And these same issues were before you, the quota problem, and I suppose monies for various functions.
you receive money for recruitment too, don't you, for recruitment drives?
Well, yes, small advertising funds, really. They were mainly spent on buying space in the UBC, and that's about all that, it wasn't a very large sum of money that was involved in that. We used to put on a couple of events that were recruitment events, and we rarely had any trouble in getting a sufficient number of recruits, and normally would select maybe one out of three who offered themselves to join the unit. And they went through a regular officer training selection process, and we had a selection committee that was composed of senior officers of the COTC itself, as well as one or two officers from outside, one from a militia unit and one from headquarters. And that would be our selection committee, the final selection committee responsible for the selection of people that presented themselves.
The year that you took over, also the Naval Training Division joined COTC.
They didn't join COTC. They joined, they came back to the campus, really. I think that this was part of a move, perhaps on the part of Discovery, to decrease their expenditures. And what they did was to move back to the campus. We provided space in the armory in the northeast corner of the main floor of the armory, and they established the naval office there. And they had a regimental staff officer, or what corresponded to a regimental staff officer, and the same as the Air Force did. That very, very markedly increased the size of the tri-service unit that we had. And we integrated very, very well together. We had a good relationship among the officers of the unit, among those who were regular staff officers who assisted the commanding officers of the unit. They worked very, very well together. Ray Herbert, who was in charge of the Air Force, is an arbitration lawyer. He's a professor in law on the campus. Morris Young was a physician, and I was a physician. And Ray Herbert said that this is why he became such a good arbitration lawyer, because he had to arbitrate between two doctors running the units. And he still talks about this. This was a very valuable experience, having to arbitrate, because when there are two doctors, he says, there are always two opinions then.
Also, at the same time that you're became commanding officer, or rather the year before, the Liberal government was back in power. And I think Hellyer was Minister of Defense?
That's right, yeah.
And right around this time, I'm not sure the year, probably 64, 65, I think integration became the main issue with the armed services.
That's right.
And I'd like you to tell me how this affected the unit and how you implemented it.
Well, the we had, as I indicated, we had already become a tri-services, had developed a tri-service setup. Now, our tri-service activities were largely tri-service activities of the mess. And our regular parades were tri-service parades, but our programs were distinct and separate. What integration brought about was an integration of the program, that the programs, part of which had already begun. We invented integration, as a matter of fact, at least this is what we've always said. But we had set up and continued more so when integration became announced, that part of the program was a common to all elements program, that everybody got involved in international studies and things of this sort. However, there is also a separate section of the program that had to do with matters that were associated solely with the Navy and the Air Force and the Army. And those would be carried on conjointly with the common to all elements programs. And what used to be done is that we'd start off the each evening with an overall kind of program, an hour spent with some particular lecture or something of this sort, with an exercise that had elements for each one of the armed forces divisions, and then after the break in the evening, they would go and take their special to an element kind of program, so that there are really like two periods in the course of the evening, one of which was common and one of which was special. And that continued. There was no real change, there was just further development along these lines. The real change came, of course, when they decided that they were going to cease to have armed forces units on the campus. That was the main fate of the integration program, and this was because they had committed themselves to training officers entirely within the armed forces complex, as it were.
I see. You retained separate uniforms, though, throughout the existence.
Yeah, we retained separate uniforms until just about the 1962, when some of our people were issued and mainly there were people in the Army who were coming from ROTP programs, they were issued with the new uniform.
The courses that you took, that the cadets took, were these dictated by headquarters?
Some of them were, and these were mainly given by the regimental staff officers, who were kept up in their summer training with the new training programs. Others of our officers also attended summer school, really, summer school for instructors, and they would come back and teach those courses in the following year. And of course, there were there are things that haven't changed all that much in terms of understanding the armed forces organization, certain elements of military law, military history, and so on, that people ought to be aware of. And we were very fortunate on our campus that we had a very large number of people that were eager to give us help, and we had people like Barry Leach, who was just an outstanding fellow in terms of military history and geopolitics, which was his special field. He was, he would come and spend maybe 8 or 10 hours in the course of a winter training program, giving lectures and holding symposia and this sort of thing.
Unpaid, voluntary?
Sometimes, certainly not paid for all the effort that they put into it. They would get a small amount for an evening's lecture, but they gave a lot more time than anybody would have been paying them for. And there are some people who came just by tradition, and this was like Freddie Soward, who came regularly and gave us a lecture on international affairs, on where the world is going today, and he would give us this as a prelude to his annual lecture to the Vancouver Institute.
So actually the courses, a lot of the courses then were really, the subject matter was determined by who was on campus and, you know, able to speak on
it. Well, it was to this extent that the curriculum was laid out, really, what areas should be covered. You know, in the first year, well, they got military law, which was one of the areas that had to be covered, plus military organization. The military law would be taken by one of the officers, and each of us would contribute to that particular side of it. The military organization would be taken by the regimental staff officer, whose responsibility it was to keep up in this particular area. And that curriculum was laid down. Then there was an area in which sort of geopolitics became part of the curriculum. Well, then you had to go out and get people from outside. And we were just wonderfully fortunate in that we had, you know, real authorities in this particular area that were willing to give us time, and much more time than we could pay for.
I'd like to go back to the integration issue again. During your commanding officers' meetings, annual meetings again, would you discuss integration? It must have been a major topic. And I wonder if you formed possibly resistance to it?
No, you see, the integration came pretty suddenly. And I think that, at least it's a personal view of mine, that Ottawa was not interested in listening to us, and the officers' meetings stopped. They had been regional meetings before, and there was no mechanism for a sort of a conjoint view of what should be done. I know that we had to pull together from our own end here whatever efforts we could make to put an influence on Ottawa. And that's why we went to people like Gordon Shrum and Larry McKenzie, Omen Solant, who I know him, he's a classmate of mine, he was Chancellor of the University of Toronto and was an advisor to the government in military affairs. I got him exercised about it. He was a a member of the COTC in Toronto years ago, and I got in contact with all of the Western commanding officers of COTCs, encouraging them to start putting pressure on the government. But the government at that point was not really listening. It had been decided by Hellyer that there was going to be integration, and that's all there was going to be.